Time for Food on Friday. Today, we're discussing the native food industry. It's an industry that's really starting to make its presence felt. It's moving out of being considered just a niche business because you can now find the products on the supermarket shelves and in more and more restaurants. Native food chef Andrew Filkey is one of the driving forces behind all this growth, and he's on the board of the Australian Native Food Industry Limited. He joins me today in the studio. G'day, Andrew.
How are you, Cameron?
Yeah, really well. Thanks for coming in. Is that fair, the way what I've said there? Is this an industry that's moving beyond just a little niche now? It's getting a bit bigger?
Well, absolutely. It's really starting to gain some momentum and critical mass now, which is fantastic for Australia. You know, you may know, Cameron, that, you know, we really only had one contribution to world food supply from our thousands of flora species, and that was the macadamia nut, transplanted to Hawaii in the 1890s, and then Americans made a great industry out of it. Finally, Australia sort of caught up, so as to speak. And there's so much more out there, which is so exciting. Fantastic ingredients. And finally, in the last 10, 20 years or so, people are starting to realise that there's a lot more growing in our backyards that we can utilise and commercialise. And hey, they belong here. Why not? Let's grow them.
There's more to us than a macadamia nut.
Absolutely.
What are the sort of products, when we talk about Australian native foods, that you refer to?
Gosh, well, ANFIL, which is Australian Native Food Industries Limited, the peak industry body, which we just formed in 2006, so we're fairly young, we've identified the top 15 traded species at the moment. I mean, as I said, there's so many more, but with a very small emerging industry, we really struggle with funds. We're all voluntary board, and we're just so passionate about seeing these amazing ingredients come to the fore. So there's many more, but that's for many years and many generations later. When I'm long dead and gone, I'm sure, for others to investigate. But right now, the top, say, 15 species include things like the amazing Kakadu plum, which has got incredibly high vitamin C and antioxidants. There's things like Davidson plums, rainforest plums. There's wattle seed, of course, which many people know of. Lemon myrtle, which is a wonderful floral citrus fragrant leaf from the subtropics. You know, the list goes on. Kwangdong, the wild peach, the desert peach. There's desert limes as well from central Queensland and so on.
Okay. So it tends to be fruits and things that grow on trees. Do you include the meat that we have in Australia as well under this umbrella?
Absolutely. In terms of the Australian native cuisine, definitely include the meats. Mm-hmm. And it's just that ANFIL, as the peak industry body, we needed to focus on just the flora. That's our constitution and our brief, because the kangaroo industry, for instance, and the emu industry, they already have established industry bodies.
Okay.
And so we decided just to focus, because there's so much to do just in even 5 or 10 new crops, let alone 50. So to cover meats and crocodile and all other things too was just never going to work.
It's too big.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And
so. So you're about to get started on a stock take of this industry. Is there very little known about just how big it is at the moment, how valuable it is?
It's very scant and sparse, the knowledge that's there at the moment. We have a bit of an idea, but we really need to find out and quantify better what sort of farm gate value, how many people exactly are involved in various little grower networks, or, for instance, the Finger Lime Growers Association of Northern New South Wales. And we need to identify exactly who's there and have all that document, find out how much they're producing annually and so on. So that covers, you know, as again, the top 15 species we're focusing on with this stock take. And it's a really important initiative that Rudic are very generously sponsoring to help us do that, because it's quite a costly exercise. You know, it's so important to understand how the industry is emerging, who's involved, what sort of employment, what sort of farm gate, and then even value-added sales are taking place, so we can really plan for the future better.
What's your feeling, though? Are we talking multi-million-dollar industry here?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, look, sort of rough estimates, you know, at the moment it could be between 10 and 25 million, I'm not sure how many thousands of people employed, but, you know, this is the information we will glean out of this very soon.
Okay. Let's talk a bit about your background.
Yep.
You've been talking about all this stuff for a while now. How did you get involved?
Well, it's quite interesting. You know, as a young cook, I did my apprenticeship in Adelaide and went straight to Europe because I was so keen to learn. And Europe was the place to go in those days. You don't have to these days because there's such fantastic food in Australia now. But back then, you had to go to Europe to learn your craft.
Back then's what, 20 years back?
Oh, more. 30-odd. In 1980, I first went and worked in Switzerland. And then I worked around Europe. And I worked in the Savoy in London. I did a winter season in Austria. Had a great time as a young guy, travelling and eating lots of great food. And I was always amazed at how the food changed and the cuisine changed, even in a country like Switzerland, from French cuisine to German and Italian and so on. And I often thought back there, why don't we have a true cuisine in Australia that we call our own, which comes from the heart, from the home? And you sort of think about how, in white man's terms anyway, since we've been here, we've sort of survived on, you know, black tea and flour and salt mutton and all that sort of stuff, or salt beef. And it was a pretty staid and boring diet that the English people bought here. So we've never really had this inherent food culture in Australia in terms of the last couple of hundred years. Of course, the Aboriginal people, of course, had their own cuisine, and they used spices and herbs and types of wrapping fish in paper bark or crabs or whatever they cooked in the ash. And so there was many different techniques used around in various communities. So there was a true Aboriginal cuisine as well, although, you know, vastly different to, you know, what we could cook on a stove. It was just very different. But
it's not fair to say that Australians didn't have curiosity, though, and didn't look to expand the horizons when it comes to cuisine, because we've looked to Europe and we've looked to Asia, to really develop.
Yeah, I think a lot of that has come from the multicultural immigration into Australia, and we've seen that, you know, like when I grew up as a boy in the River Murray in Remark, we didn't eat my mum wouldn't have cooked spaghetti bolognese, and you know, dare I say it, we would have called that back in the old days wog food. And, you know, that's not a nice term these days. But, you know, it's now we would, you know, we embrace this Italian cuisine, the Thai and the Vietnamese, all these cuisines we embrace now. I think Australians are waking up and understanding there's so much more to food. And I think we've got to thank the multicultural.
We celebrate it as part of our big cities in particular, don't we?
Yeah.
So tell me a bit about the sort of dishes and the sort of products that really got you up and going and established once you opened your own restaurant back here
in
Australia.
Exactly. I mean, my first time I ever combined two native foods was in Adelaide when I came back from Europe. I found kangaroo meat was available through the butcher, which was never available before for human consumption. I thought, wow, that's fantastic, because that's been, you know, legal to eat for human consumption in South Australia for many years.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just a superb meat if cooked correctly, you know, because it's very lean, high protein, very healthy. And I cooked that with these kwangdongs, the wild peaches, because I read an article about this guy called Brian Powell who started the first commercial kwangdong orchard in corn in the mid-north of South Australia. And I thought, you know, I used to play marbles with kwangdong stones when I grew up as a kid on the River Murray. But my mum never used to cook kwangdong jam or make kwangdong pies. And I thought, why not? I just tried this fruit for the first time, you know, when I'm about 25. And I thought, this is crazy. It's a magnificent wild peach. Why don't we use it?
And it'd been under your nose the whole time.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's that sort of, that was a true light bulb moment for me. And I said, and it went snap. And I said, there's something here. There's something we're overlooking in Australia, and we've got to investigate it. And I've been on that crusade ever since.
But how did you go about it? You discovered the roux meat and the kwangdong.
Yeah.
Was it a case of trial and error?
Absolutely,
from there?
Yeah. But a lot of information was already known, and I started to get more information for other people like Vic Cherikov, who started collecting bush foods for commercial sale and so on. And it was a matter of, say, like, you know, okay, Illawarra plums, it's got a light pine sort of plum type flavour. Let's do that in a recipe where I might use other plums or a cherry type dish or something, you know. And so I developed...
you take an established dish, something you knew, and
that's right.
Substitute
and
ingredients.
You look for those flavours in it. Mm. Like lemon myrtle has a lovely floral citrus sort of aroma and flavour, magnificent. I think, okay, well, I'll do something like I might use with kaffir lime or lemon verbena, which is not dissimilar. So we start to sort of work into those recipes where you have some knowledge already, and that's the best way.
And then what does it evolve to the point where you pretty much have dishes that are essentially native foods, yep, Australian foods?
I'll give you a really good example. In the Savoy in London, we used to make bisque d'Omar, the classic lobster bisque, okay, which is a French classic soup, wonderful soup, made from the shellfish, you know, the shell of the lobsters. But here in Australia, I've taken a very multicultural approach. We use yabby, so we make a yabby bisque.
Mm-hmm.
Then I add lots of galangal ginger and chilli, kaffir lime leaves, lemon myrtle leaves, Thai fish sauce and palm sugar. I make this wonderfully intense and complex yabby bisque with lemon myrtle, which has got very much a Thai flavouring. So we have, you know, classic French soup, Australian ingredients and Thai influence. So how more multicultural can you get? And that's amazing soup.
And yabby meat, I think, is a fantastic meat.
It's gorgeous. And it's, as is marin. Yeah.
Yes, yeah, as well. And often a bit cheaper than some of the other options,
yes,
I guess.
True.
Yeah. Okay, so one of the things that really interests me here is this contradiction in some ways when it comes to consumer attitudes between this love of local food, but yet this reluctance to embrace some of these ingredients, or maybe a lack of knowledge about what to do with them.
I think it's that lack of knowledge and understanding is a huge part of it. And I think, you know, things are changing though, information, technology and all that, and what's available on that. People are starting to be more inquisitive. I think there's a bit of this MasterChef factor as well, where young Australians now are embracing unique and high quality and different foods and cooking interesting meals at home more than they ever were, which is really wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And so people are inquiring more, you know, there's definitely a groundswell of interest in these ingredients. And it's so important for us as a peak industry body to look on how we can educate people and make more people aware of these ingredients and how to use them in the future.
I'm speaking with native food chef Andrew Filkey. This is Food on Friday on Bush Telegraph. Now, part of that education process is, will be taking place next week as part of the Melbourne Food and Wine Festival.
That's right. In fact, even starting today, right as we speak, we're unpacking some magnificent botanical artworks and indigenous artworks, which depict quite a range, some 10 or 15 species, I think we've done, of native foods at the Atrium in Fed Square. We have got the Art of Native Foods exhibition. It's an umbrella event of the Melbourne Food and Wine Festival, that great event. And we're really looking forward to the next 10 days. It's literally there from about 10 in the morning till 5 or 6 at night. So come along, wander through and have a look at these amazing artworks. And what we're aiming to do as well is have on display some of the raw native ingredients. So if you see an artwork with some bush tomatoes there, you will have some bush tomatoes to have a look at, and lemon myrtle leaves, etc. Yeah.
So if you're in Melbourne, there's an opportunity. You mentioned the indigenous artwork there.
Yeah.
Along your journey of learning more about these foods and what to do with them, how important has indigenous knowledge been?
Oh, look, it's been essential to understand, and that process of us white people learning from the indigenous peoples of Australia has begun right since day one with Joseph Banks helping out in the bank and in Botany Bay and starting as a botanist to look at the plants and what Aboriginal people were eating at the time. And so all throughout the modern history of Australia for the last couple hundred years, there's been information recorded but not necessarily used commercially for the benefit of the food industry. So there's information there about these indigenous foods. So we've learnt all along the way. But more recently, a lot of great work was done with people like Vic Cherikov, who studied the composition and preparation techniques of Aboriginal food as part of his work with the Sydney University, I think it was. And I've really enjoyed the couple of times I've been out on various forays, particularly with the Anyamatna people in Flinders Ranges, the Gammon Ranges, Flinders Ranges area of northern South Australia. I've been on a bit of a camping tour with some of the elders there and learning about some of their traditional foods, which is wonderful. Only October last year, I hosted René Redzepi, the world's number one chef from Noma in Copenhagen, and we took him again to the Igawata, the Aboriginal Cultural Centre, and Tom there took us on a bit of a tour, and it was just wonderful to get their interpretation and for them to impart some knowledge to us. It was a wonderful exchange.
How do you make sure, though, when you take these world leaders in the industry to an Indigenous community, how do you make sure that the knowledge isn't just mined and that the local people don't benefit? How do you incorporate them along the way to make sure that there's economic gain if they want it?
Absolutely. Look, this is a really critical area, and it's part of our charter with ANFIL, the peak industry body, is to the engagement and inclusion of Indigenous peoples. And we are hoping to try and get an Indigenous person onto our board. We did have one earlier, but she had to leave. That was right back in the very start. But, you know, we want to engage more with Aboriginal people. And one of the ways that industry is doing that, in fact, is the Coles Indigenous Food Fund, which is a fantastic initiative by Coles that also in turn supports some of the activities of ANFIL for the betterment of the industry as a whole. And that is to the Indigenous Food Fund, where there's a couple of product lines on the shelves, Outback Spirit and soon to be my Takaroo range, will be contributing to an Indigenous food fund through a royalty. And that money then goes towards industry development and grants towards Indigenous communities. Now, I'm not sure how many communities are currently have been funded under that grant, but I know under those grants and that scheme, but I know there's probably at least three or four that I'm aware of. But actually, Coles will be giving some more information on that at the media breakfast on Monday morning we're having.
Okay.
So, yeah, absolutely, Indigenous involvement is very critical.
Okay. Before I let you go, for people who are interested in exploring this area for cooking at home, we'll put some of your recipes up on the website, but just give us a broad idea of where to start. What's an easy way to get into this?
Okay. Look, whether you can find a packet of lemon myrtle or some wattle seed, or if you happen to be able to get hold of some kwangdongs in kwangdong season or whatever, I mean, the best thing you can do is obviously try them, or like, for instance, say wattle seed. When you smell it, it's got a lovely sort of roast coffee-like character, a bit sort of nutty, a chicory-like flavour as well. So you think, well, I'll use it in some sort of preparations where I might use a coffee-type flavour. So maybe dessert applications, certainly wattle seed pavlova is wonderful. You can mix it into whipped cream and infuse it into custards and sauces, pancakes, wattle seed and walnut bread is a lovely bread. So you can just start to sort of look for the flavour that you can identify and think how you might use it in another
in what you're doing flavor. Already.
Exactly.
Don't be scared. Make mistakes along
Absolutely.
The way. Eh? As you said, you made a few yourself and
I haven't
weren't put off by them. All right. As I said, we'll put some of Andrew Filkey's recipes up on the website after the program. Andrew, good luck with the next week or so with the Melbourne Food and Wine Festival. Thank you for coming in. Really appreciate it.
Excellent.
That's Andrew Filkey, who is a native food chef and also a board member, rather, of the Australian Native Food Industry Limited.